Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The first photos of oil-soaked birds appeared today. The spill that began with an explosion on an oil platform 10 days ago has now reached the Louisiana shores and threatens to ooze onto the entire Gulf coastline. Could it get any worse? Yes, it could. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice Independent Insurance Agents, offering a choice of companies and coverage. You can find a local agent at 1-800-WE-INSURE. And by Constant Contact, working to help small businesses understand what social media can do for them. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. It is the 30th and final day of April. As if things weren't bad enough in the Gulf Coast already, storms are in the forecast, bringing high winds to choppy waters already polluted with hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil. The Coast Guard, the National Guard, shrimp boats, and contractors are trying desperately to clean up the spill. Meanwhile, the White House dispatched inspectors to the Gulf to check safety conditions aboard deepwater rigs. And federal officials blasted British Petroleum, the owner of the downed rig, for not doing more to contain the damage. Is a federal safety crackdown on the offshore oil industry far behind? Brett Neely has more from Washington.
Tighter regulation is inevitable, says Tyler Priest of the University of Houston. He's written several histories about offshore drilling in the Gulf.
There will be new legislation, I'm sure, and possibly, you know, new regulations about blowout preventers. That seems to be the obvious one.
He's talking about a valve that can seal off a wellhead underwater. That seems to have malfunctioned, and U.S. regulators don't require remote-controlled shutoff switches. Zach Corrigan of the nonprofit Food and Water Watch says he hopes regulators will now pay more attention. Currently, many industry safety procedures are voluntary. Corrigan says the industry is under the gun to produce more oil at a time of high prices.
You have this very complex industry with this rush to go out and drill deeper and faster. It's just a recipe for cutting corners.
Eric Smith is with the industry-backed Tulane Energy Institute in New Orleans. He says oil companies in the Gulf are already heavily regulated. Smith agrees new rules are coming, though he thinks more regulation will cut Gulf oil production.
Ultimately, all of these trade-offs become economic.
Production in the Gulf means the U.S. may have to import more oil from overseas. That oil will be shipped by tanker. And Smith says until this spill, most of the country's worst spills were caused by tanker accidents.
So you will have an increase in risk, perhaps, you know, not intended, but the net effect will be you'll have more tankers running around the coastal parts of the United States than you do today.
The spill could be the first in a series of headaches for the oil industry. Democratic Congressman Ed Markey said yesterday that he plans to hold hearings with oil company CEOs about the spill. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Today marks one of the first deadlines in the new health insurance law. States have to decide whether to take federal money to run a new insurance pool for people with serious medical problems or to tell the feds to run it themselves. With few exceptions, the states were divided along party lines. But as Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports from the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, there is a little bit more than politics involved.
Dick Netley is a structural engineer in Omaha. His daughter, Kristen, was born with severe respiratory problems. Her early care was more than insurance could pay for.
She went through a $1 million cap in about 19 months.
Kristen died 8 years ago at age 13. Her father says if she had survived to adulthood,
she would have been uninsurable. No insurance company would have touched her.
Netley didn't want other families to have to worry about that. So he joined the board of Nebraska's High Risk Pool. It's a state-subsidized insurance program for people that private insurers won't cover. High-risk pools are, by definition, money losers for states because the people in them are so sick. In 2014, when the health care exchanges kick in, all state high-risk pools will disappear.
Pre-existing conditions become a thing of the past. There will no longer be anyone who would be considered medically uninsurable.
Genia Sajian is a spokesperson for California's risk pool. Until 2014, she says, healthcare reform law will provide some temporary relief. It gives $5 billion to the states to help build up high-risk pool programs. States have until today to decide whether they will run the program with federal money or let the feds run the pool in their states.
They say, let the feds do it. Okay, well, the feds are going to hire somebody to do it.
Cecil Bykirk is the executive director for high-risk pools in Iowa, Alaska, and Montana. He says states that say no to the money will still get a high-risk pool, but the state government won't be the face of it. That could be the idea. Even these new high-risk pools are likely to have quotas and long waiting lists.
When the pool gets capped and people can't get in, that guy's going to be angry.
Bykirk says some states would rather that anger, when it comes, be directed at Washington. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Today, the Prime Minister of Greece, George Papandreou, said the country's very survival is at stake. Without billions of dollars in emergency loans, the government could go bust. Word from Berlin today is that the Germans are now prepared to help, at a price. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story from London.
Most Germans oppose bailing out Greece. That's why Chancellor Merkel has dragged her feet. Her government faces a crucial election on May the 9th. She could lose control of the upper house of parliament. Nevertheless, Merkel is going to upset her voters. She'll have the rescue package approved by the end of next week. Analyst Heinz Schulter says Merkel had no choice. There is now a real danger of the crisis spreading across the eurozone.
I think the situation is so dramatic, particularly against the background now, if you look at Portugal and Spain, that something had to be done. She couldn't wait. And I'm sure she is not comfortable with that position.
To limit the political damage at home, Merkel insisted on much tougher medicine for Greece, like higher taxes and cuts in public sector pay by up to 20%. But the recent austerity measures provoke violent protests and strikes in Athens. There's serious doubt the Greek government will be able to administer even more pain. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a downer end to the month. We'll have details when we do the numbers. If you haven't yet signed on the dotted line to buy a house, you will have to do it without Uncle Sam's help. The home buyer tax credit expires today. Gotta have a contract in hand. But there is also news on the other end of the market. A new study finds a spike in the number of so-called strategic defaults, also known as walking away from your mortgage. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more on what's behind the willingness to just hand the keys to the bank.
The Financial Trust Index is a quarterly snapshot of just that, our collective trust in the nation's financial system. The study found that the number of strategic defaults rose to 31% of all U.S. foreclosures in March. That's up about 10% from a year ago.
It's a little bit like a contagion effect, like a disease.
That's Northwestern University finance professor Paola Sapienza, who co-wrote the study. She says people consider more than their bank balance when thinking about defaulting on a home.
Do I have to move the kids to a different school? Do I lose my friends because they start looking at me in a way that I don't like that? So, you know, here is the social stigma.
But Sapienza's research found that fear of social stigma is eroding.
If everybody else is doing it, then it may become more acceptable socially.
Overall, foreclosure activity is up about 16% compared to the same time last year. Rick Sharga follows foreclosure for RealtyTrack. He's noticed what he calls a new mentality.
I think we're looking at a different social construct than what we've seen historically, where your home was your castle and you would fight just about to the death to do anything you could to avoid losing it.
He says we could see another avalanche of foreclosures begin this summer as adjustable loans reset at higher rates. In psychological terms, those higher rates could help borrowers rationalize defaulting on a home. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The gold Goldman Sachs story just keeps on giving. First, we had a grilling on Capitol Hill on Tuesday, now a criminal probe into its dealings. And, miracle of miracles, the debate over financial reform may finally be moving forward. So, today for the weekly wrap on Wall Street and Beyond, we are going to be talking to Fortune's Lee Gallagher. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Tess.
And independent financial journalist John Carney is with us as well. Hi, John.
Hi.
So, guys, today's Goldman news, of course, is that federal prosecutors launching a criminal investigation into Goldman. Now, we should say that charges may never come of this, but how much trouble is the bank really in, do you think? John?
I think the criminal investigation is very, very bad for Goldman Sachs. It's a worst-case scenario. Even if no charges come of it, it really brings up a whole host of issues for clients that have to deal with them. If you're a corporate board and you say, you know, we're going to hire Goldman Sachs to be our investment banker for a deal we're doing, you have to consider whether or not you have a fiduciary duty not to hire somebody under criminal investigation by the FBI. That's not a question Goldman wants its customers asking.
Lee, any chance here that Lloyd Blankfein might lose his job?
I think there's a chance. I would put it right now at a small chance. But I would actually disagree with John here a little bit. I mean, first of all, it's a preliminary probe. It's not at all clear whether prosecutors will actually bring charges. I mean, as you mentioned, Tess, there's lots of investigations launched that don't result in any charges.
Sure.
Secondly, I mean, even for the SEC, this case is complicated. For the criminal probe, you know, they have to improve intent to break the law. And just keep in mind that no one has yet been convicted of criminal charges in this whole financial crisis.
Yeah, we haven't had any perp walks.
No, we haven't. And we're just kind of waiting for them. I think
right.
The public is just sort of salivating and really waiting for one. But I'm not quite sure this is going to be it. It's far from certain.
Well, it wasn't a perp walk, but it was certainly a public flogging on Tuesday for these Goldman Sachs executives, including, of course, Fabrice Tour, who has been charged in the civil fraud case by the SEC. CEO Lloyd Blankfein was up on the Hill as well. Did we learn anything here, John?
I think it was very educational. What we learned was that the guys at Goldman Sachs have a certain way of looking at themselves and their job. Even in front of the congressman, I could sense a bit of arrogance and contempt. I think it was useful for America to witness that coming from these investment bankers.
But Lee, you know, the question that was asked over and over again was, do you feel that you had a duty to tell your clients that the investment may not pan out for them? Nobody seemed to say yes.
They are saying they absolutely did not do anything wrong, and that is definitely still up for debate. I mean, this is going to come down to the SEC's rules and whether Goldman was in violation of them, and it's very murky. It's not at all clear. So Goldman is definitely mounting a huge defense.
Well, let's move on to Senator Dodd's financial reform bill that's finally been allowed to go to the Senate floor for some public debate. Anything in there that could change bank behavior at this point, perhaps even prevent another financial disaster, John?
No.
No.
That's the quick answer. Almost nothing that they're actually putting in there will prevent banks from blowing themselves up. The banks won't have to shut down one trading desk. They won't have to sell off one hedge fund. There is nothing that will prevent another crisis or another bailout. And if anything, it will make sure that the taxpayers are forever on the hook.
And John, I know one of the big sticking points in this legislation is this notion that banks should have collateral to back up these risky derivatives contracts. Can that work?
It can, and it's a good idea. The banks are undercapitalized. This is a way of forcing them to retain more capital. That is a very good idea. Unfortunately, AIG collateralized the credit default swaps that it wrote, and it blew up. So it's not a guarantee, but it is a good idea to force banks to have more collateral.
And Lee, your thoughts on this bill?
Well, I think that parts of it can actually affect behavior. I think the proposal for a consumer protection agency can actually do a lot to rein in banks' behavior in the future. I also think that the proposal for some way to sort of unwind the big banks if they get into trouble without having a bailout, that's a good idea. But, you know, you're never going to be able to plug up every hole because whatever we prevent for this time is not going to prevent what happens down the road.
Fortune's Lee Gallagher and financial journalist John Carney. Great to talk to you guys. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Tess.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, rap music and the art and economics of making it big.
They're all out there releasing music online and hoping to somehow achieve some sort of stardom, but nobody even knows what stardom looks like anymore.
But first, let's do the numbers. Financial companies led the markets lower today. The Dow slid 1.4%, 158 points to 11,008. The NASDAQ ditched 2%, 50 points to finish at 2461. And the S&P 500 fumbled 1.2%, 20 points ending at 1186. For the week, the Dow lost 1.2%. The NASDAQ ticked down 2.7%. And the S&P 500 lowered 2.7% as well. Goldman Sachs led the change down market, falling more than 9%. Bank of America crumbled 2.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase withdrew 3.25%. Bonds rose, and the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering more young people to achieve educational success beyond high school. And by Vanguard. Vanguarding is an investment philosophy designed to help individuals reach their financial goals. Vanguard.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on how much we earned and how much left our wallets in March. Honk if you bought a new car in April. U.S. automakers release sales figures for the month. Knock, knock. Who's there? Probably a census taker if you're one of the roughly 48 million households left to be counted. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. It's been application mania for college-bound high school seniors this year. Many of them sent out more applications than ever, hoping to boost their choices of not just getting in, but of getting financial aid. Tomorrow, the clock runs out. Time to say I do to your choice of school and put down some earnest money to reserve a spot. Those of you caught up in this drama the past few weeks know just how agonizing a choice it can be. And for many, money is a deciding factor, especially in this economy. From the Marketplace Education Desk, Amy Scott reports.
At Layla Goodman's home in Gloucester, Massachusetts, the dining room table is covered with college acceptance letters and financial aid offers. She's filled the margins with math.
You can see all the numbers all over. Can we do it? Can we do it? What if I subtract that? What if I subtract this?
Goodman's son, Reeve Moyer, has been trying to choose between the University of Massachusetts Amherst and Ithaca College, a private liberal arts school. With financial aid, UMass would cost them about $13,000 a year out of pocket. Reeve would graduate debt-free. Ithaca would cost about $28,000, and Reeve would have to take out loans.
We wrestled and wrestled, and we went back and forth, and I asked Reeve, if money wasn't a factor, where would you go? And he chose Ithaca.
Reeve wants to study sports management. He thought he'd get more personal attention at Ithaca.
I guess the smaller community and the fact that I'd be treated as a person that I felt more than at UMass Amherst with 17,000 other undergrads or however many it is, I felt I'd be treated as just like another number there.
It'll be a stretch for his parents. Goodman is a high school dean and teacher. Reeve's father is a carpenter and energy consultant. They have no savings for college. And for the next 2 years, they'll have two kids in private schools.
Half of our income is going to go to college payments. I don't know. You have to ask me in 6 months when I can't go out to dinner ever. But I do feel proud that my kids care enough to take it really seriously.
Money is weighing heavily on college decisions this year. Though household incomes fell last year, the average tuition at public colleges rose 6.5%. The recession has forced many families to reconsider what they can afford.
Dear Kimberly Herbine, congratulations on your offer of admission to the University of Central Florida. UCF is
in Drescher, Pennsylvania, a suburb of Philadelphia. Kim Herbine reads an acceptance letter. With scholarships and loans, Central Florida will cost the family about $6,000 a year out of pocket. Kim's older sister, Jessica, is a sophomore at Drexel University in Philadelphia. She expects to graduate with $48,000 in student loans. Their father, Dave Herbine, says when it came time for Kim to look at schools, the economy had changed.
It just got me thinking a lot more about, you know, what's the worth of a college education? How much debt should you really be willing to take on?
With so many recent graduates struggling to find work, he also worried about Kim's job prospects after college. She chose Central Florida over a more expensive school because it offered better career training.
Central Florida had a 100% placement after graduation for their College of Hospitality, and that pretty much set me there right away, and I had a scholarship there as well.
To save money, the Herbines plan to drive Kim down to school in August. She signed up for frequent flyer miles to save on future flights back home. But for many students, going far away is no longer an option. John Boschhoven is a guidance counselor at a public high school in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Many more parents say, we're looking closer to home because we can't afford the travel. We can't even afford necessarily to get out to visit the colleges as much as we would have wanted to.
Hey, girls. In Gloucester, Layla Goodman is already planning ways to save money next year.
So we've built new garden beds on the other side, and we are going to grow some food. So we thought we could save some money there and eat really healthy. Here's our asparagus growing here. We would do it anyhow because we like it. And our chickens provide us with good, fresh eggs.
Her son, Reeve, is relieved to have made up his mind.
I purchased the colored sweatshirt, so now it's official. I joined the official class page on Facebook. I'm going to Ithaca.
They mailed the $400 deposit this week. Their first big payment is due in June. In Gloucester, Massachusetts, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
For years, rap superstars were all about the dollar signs. Guys like Ludacris rhymed about sipping Cristal and wearing as much bling as you could stand.
Now where'd you get that platinum chain with them diamonds in it?
But the business model of making it big as a rap star has changed a lot in the last couple of years. Record companies aren't selling CDs like they used to, and the internet has made it easy to bypass the labels entirely. In fact, a rap recession is underway, at least according to Tom Bryan. He's a staff writer for Pitchfork.com. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Remind us how the rap stars of old, old being a relative term here, how did they make it big, say a Jay-Z or a Ludacris?
They came up originally within their cities, making the sort of music that appealed to those cities and fit within an aesthetic, because rap is a very local music.
Mm-hmm.
Jay-Z makes New York music because he's from New York.
Yeah, I'm up at Brooklyn, now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow, but I'll be hood forever.
Welcome to Atlanta where the players play, and we ride on them things like every day.
Ludacris is from Atlanta, he makes Atlanta music, and they rise up within the ranks of their city, getting other artists to do guest spots on their albums, releasing music independently, hoping the bigger labels would maybe notice. And then as time goes on, they make their way into the mainstream and they start making music that combines whatever they were originally doing, ideally, with pop music in general.
What do you think is going to drive rap's success in the future?
There's still the possibility that, you know, somebody can make it to a major label, sell a few hundred thousand records, but the music business is shrinking. And so right now, it has to change focus, go small. These guys have to build up these small little devoted fan bases. That way they can tour nightclubs. The real success stories are these kind of small level guys. Like there's a guy from Pittsburgh named Wiz Khalifa who has no major label contract at all. but who releases three or four of these mixtapes for free to his fans online and then sells out clubs across the country and makes a decent living for himself doing that.
It sounds like then the rap genre had a better hold on this whole going free on the internet phenomenon than perhaps other modes of music.
In a way it did, but it's interesting now because the actual mechanics of selling a record have eluded a whole lot of people, and rappers are absolutely no exception. And since rap is like culturally sort of a music in which money is very important,
right,
it's been this sort of identity crisis period that we're seeing right now.
Has the economy played a role in some of these changes recently, at least over the last couple of years?
With the music business, it's hard to say where the economy begins and where downloading and the business's basic lack of competence over the past 10 or 15 years ends.
Yeah.
Artists, they're all out there releasing music online and hoping to somehow achieve some sort of stardom, but nobody even knows what stardom looks like anymore. Like, there's basically no rap mainstream any longer at all. There's your Jay-Z's and then there's everybody else.
Tom Bryan is the author of Grind to Get It, Rap's Recession, and you can find that article at pitchfork.com. Thanks so much.
Great. Thanks a lot for having me.
Marketplace is supported by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. By Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, how you feeling about the man today? If you're like most Americans, you have more loyalty to your favorite TV show than you do to the folks who sign your paycheck. A Reuters Ipsos poll found Americans are committed first to country, then family, then doctor. And they are more loyal to brand names than to their own companies. As in, sorry, boss, I'm with Pepsi. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 158 points, 1.4%. The NASDAQ shaved off 50 points, about 2%. And the S&P 500 dropped 20 points, 1.2%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, this weekend, when the market hit bottom, lots of people broke the number one rule of investing. What were they thinking? Well, they weren't.
When we panic, we literally lose our mind. We disconnect from the logical part of our brain. It is gone.
Hope you can join us for that. Kai Rizdahl will be back with this program on Monday. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.